Well, this is now our second emergency Boston Golden State podcast of the year. 1:40 a.m. Pacific time. I am joined by the dean of NBA Night Owls. I guess not the dean. Ethan Strauss, before I mess up your introduction anymore, what's up, man?
I like being a dean of Night Owls. It sounds okay. It makes me sound a little creepy, but I'll accept it. I'll go with it.
Yeah, I already introduced David Locke this week as the dean of NBA podcasters. I think that just got into my head. So even though it made absolutely no sense, the Warriors' 54-game home win streak is over. Their dreams of a 41-0 home schedule are also over. 73-9, looking a little
bit more dubious now.
Wait
a second, who actually dreams of a 41-0 home schedule? What kind of dream is this?
I don't know. I think the fans probably do.
You have a specific, you go into unconsciousness and you dream of winning 41 games and you wake up and say, I just had the craziest dream. I'm sorry. This is a very literalist way. I've messed up your introduction.
This podcast is not going the way I dreamed
it would. Oh, that is a professional segue, my friend. Continue on.
So, yeah, Boston pulled a 1985 Miami Dolphins on the Warriors. They had the record at 40-1. The Warriors could have broken that, and Boston prevented them from doing it. How did it happen?
Well, first of all, Boston played better. I think that's a key component, is that they outplayed the home team. But kidding aside, it was a very Boston Celtics effort, right? It was scrappy. It was very much influenced by the pressure from their perimeter defensive players. I know that you observed that, unlike some teams that have recently against Curry, the way to guard him is to switch those pick and rolls. In the beginning, they weren't doing it at all, or a lot, and that is their style. It's not as though they were doing something unusual for them, because when you have really scrappy, active perimeter defenders, you want to keep them on that guy. And they don't exactly have the best big man defenders either to switch onto Curry. So it makes sense, but it seemed to throw him off his game. And he had some early turnovers. And as you were also lamenting, it seemed like the Warriors probably weren't doing enough pick and roll with Curry and, say, Draymond Green or Andrew Bogut.
Yeah, against the great defensive teams, especially the one, Memphis was a prime example last year, right? Like their bigs had no chance guarding Curry in pick and roll, and yet for, you know, really three games against Memphis, they tried to run him off the ball, and Mike Conley was awesome at just holding him and not letting him get away, or at least for those two games, games two and three that they lost. And sometimes the Warriors, they want to play the beautiful game, they want to move the ball. That egalitarian system has been fantastic for them. But sometimes when it's not working, Steph Curry in a pick and roll against the other team's crappy big man is a way to get a great shot every single time.
Yeah, especially when you have somebody like Amir Johnson, where I don't know if he is the most aware defensively out there as far as what to do, or at least he wasn't exactly that on this night. And I thought
he was fine. Nothing really popped out to me about him. I mean, I think Sullinger is another, and Olynyk actually probably I thought were worse than he was. I mean, Amir had his offensive problems, of course, mm-hmm. I will respectfully disagree.
You'll
with
disagree
you
on my on killing of Amir Johnson.
I think to me though, everyone's talking about the turnovers. They did have 22 turnovers. 12 of those theoretically were unforced, but I think a lot of it, the pressure, you know, kind of caused them to throw it out of bounds. Boston had 10 steals. Avery Bradley with his hands was unbelievable. I thought the bigger problem, though, was that Golden State just couldn't stop Boston in the second half.
Yeah, that was the big problem. It was a great third quarter. It was fantastic. It was a 37-36 third quarter. But the Warriors, in many ways, lost this game defensively. Well, at the beginning, offensively, they were hindered, and they didn't compensate for that enough, and they didn't. And you know, it's funny. I thought maybe Bogut getting hurt maybe it added to the defensive maladies, but really they were getting killed defensively when Bogut was in the game.
Yeah, he was, and I thought even in the first half, although Boston did not score well, they were able to be effective. Jared Sullinger hitting his jump shot was really big. He's shooting only 28% from three, but he was 2-2, and he hit a couple of other long jumpers. Kelly Olynyk also caused problems for the reserves. And I asked Steve Kerr about what role that spacing had in the Warriors' inability to stop the Celtics. Here's what he had to say.
You all really struggled to stop them in the second half. How did the shooting of their centers contribute to that? It looked like they were able to get right down the lane with that spacing.
Yeah, well, that's what they do. I mean, they're a perimeter team in terms of the way they attack. They play actually a similar style to us, you know, with a lot of dribble handoffs and you know, bigs popping out and running your offense through bigs. And when you got, you know, guys like Sullinger and Olynyk who can step out, Yurebko, then it's you know, it's it forces you to cover a lot of floor, and that's usually what we do to other teams, but they did it to us.
Yeah, and so as Steve noted, it was kind of ironic that the Celtics were doing pretty much exactly what the Warriors like to do to them. But, you know, with them being down Iguodala and down Azeli, who's a little bit more mobile, is it really true that they just, you know, with Spates, Varejao, and Bogut, you got to play most of those guys? You can't play Draymond at center that much when you don't also have Iguodala as well? I mean, were they just, you know, they just didn't have enough horses to deal with those shooting centers?
Well, this is the big question right now, and the big frustration in Warrior Land, and it's a momentary frustration in theory. Should Varejao be playing as much as he's playing? And this was probably, even though he had his moments of awfulness, one of the better Varejao games. That is damning with faint praise.
Better first half. I thought he was awful in the second half.
Yeah.
And just Barbosa, Curry had some uncharacteristic mental mistakes. Sean Livingston had a couple of times where he lost guys. I mean, they really just screwed up mentally. I mean, they probably gave up, you know, probably 5, 6, 7 buckets in the second half alone just due to mental mistakes. And that's something that you don't really see very often from this Warriors team.
And really, it's the only way that a Boston team like this is going to score. They don't have overwhelming talent offensively. It wasn't a good defensive performance. And I do want to return to that idea, though, just because it's an interesting one. It's divorced from the game. How much would you be playing Varejao? What would you be doing?
Before I respond to Ethan's question about my opinion on the Warriors playing Anderson Varejao, which there's absolutely no way you can anticipate the answer to, let's talk about Indochino Custom Menswear. This is a sponsor that is near and dear to my heart because I'm somewhat of an oddly shaped guy. I've struggled for a long time to find suits off the rack, but made-to-measure suits were always too expensive until now. Today, my listeners can get any premium suit for just $3.99, up to 50% off at Indochino.com. When you enter that familiar cap space code that we use for all the sponsors at checkout, you'll get free shipping. You take 14 separate measurements of your body, send them off to Indochino.com. 3 to 4 weeks later, you have a custom suit that will fit you perfectly. And if it doesn't, you can send it back and they will retailer it for you for free. And then if it still doesn't work for you, you can always return it and get a full refund. Indochino.com is the best way to get a suit that fits you perfectly. Enter that cap space code and you can get your look your way at Indochino.com.
Well, I think listeners to the podcast know that I would be playing him kind of as little as possible, although in this instance, Bogut or Spates probably weren't really much better as a defensive option. I mean, you saw, and maybe I might have even gone with someone like McAdoo, who had a little bit more mobility.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, generally, I would not be playing Berger. I think offensively, he is just a total record scratch guy. He can't finish. He doesn't even make his free throws. He can't hit a mid-ranger. I mean, there's really nothing that he's doing well offensively. And then defensively, he really screws up the communication a fair amount, and he doesn't have the athleticism to defend and pick and roll or protect the rim either. So yeah, I would be playing him less. I'd be going with Spates a little bit more. But I wouldn't say that's why they necessarily lost this game. That's kind of more of a general thing.
And the defensive communication aspect is interesting because they got him because he's a smart player, and Jason Thompson couldn't grasp their system offensively or defensively. And you can see flashes of it, how he understands how people cut, and he's a good passer, not a great passer, but he's a good passer. But defensively, he is not he is not exhibiting, I'm not impugning his intelligence, but he's not exhibiting the floor IQ that maybe they expected or wanted when they got him. And there are clear instances where schematically he's not doing what they want, or he's misunderstanding what to do. That much is clear so far.
Yeah, he actually has to be told what to do on offense two or three times a game as well, just like what play they're running and stuff. I will take a little bit of issue with what you said that about the Celtics not having the talent to go one-on-one, and maybe that's true in the aggregate, but their shot-making actually, especially in the fourth quarter, was sublime. Evan Turner had three or four really tough shots that he made, like that one along the baseline against Sean Livingston, I think that put them up seven with 2 minutes left. Like, that was a crazy shot. Thomas is an unbelievable finisher at the rim, and once he got going, he was really difficult to stop.
I just think of Thomas as somebody where if I put length on him, he's going to be quelled.
Yeah, but I mean that you can screen that guy off of him though, and I think the problem was that once Bogut really started sticking to Solinger, and then they got a lot of switches too with Spates and Varejao. When Olynyk came in, they were really scared of Olynyk's pick and pop. So then there were a ton of switches in which Spates got onto guys like Smart. I'm rambling a little bit because you're talking about Thomas. I don't think that length on him is necessarily the answer because he is a pretty good operator in the pick and roll. I agree they did a great job on him in the first half, but he was able to get loose in the second half.
Oh, yeah, and it was impressive, and you are correct about his finishing around the rim. It's one of the more, at least to me, to use the word impressive again, feats that he is able to be so great. He has a variety of layup styles and can finish with either hand. And he also just did, he did a good job. He did a good job attacking Bogut. I was impressed with how he attacked Bogut, both off the switch when Bogut was switched onto him, and he didn't do that stupid dribble around and fire up a long two. He just got into his hip and he drew a foul. And also just attacking him at the rim as well. I think he had at least on one floater. So I don't mean to slight Isaiah Thomas, but I do think that even though that Boston works well in the aggregate and as a collective, I think that the Warriors, if they were disciplined defensively, shouldn't have had anywhere near the problems that they had.
I thought that Kerr really blew it by not putting Draymond Green on Solinger once Solinger started shooting and putting Bogut on Amir Johnson. I didn't really understand what the point of that was. Maybe they were worried that Solinger was going to back down on Green, but the two post-ups that Solinger had on Green stopped him. You know, I wouldn't be too worried about that.
The second one, he was moving him. I mean, that was an amazing sequence. The collisions involved in it. I mean, I could see the thinking behind that because Solinger was capable, and not many bigs are, actually. He was capable of moving Draymond. That's not exactly the same thing as getting the shot attempt to go in, though.
Well, and it also, that's the lesser of two evils once you realize that your 7 foot center is now standing 20 feet from the basket and they're getting layup after layup on you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's time to switch it up and see if there's something else that you might go to. And I think Solinger posting up, I mean, at the very least, you can double team him or something. That's still better if he's really going to kill Draymond, which, you know, he probably isn't going to, frankly. So I thought that was one thing that Kerr messed up. I thought that Brad Stevens coached a great game, with maybe one small exception of waiting a little too long to bring his guys back in the fourth. But other than that, I thought he was fantastic.
Yeah, I have no complaints as far as what Stevens was doing. And you're right about Bogut. If he's not near the rim defensively, then it's kind of like, why is he in the game?
Yeah, well, he's in the game because they didn't have anyone else. I guess you could say that. I mean, Bradley was unbelievable defensively. I mean, some of the closeouts that he had on Steph or on Clay, I mean, he really locked down Clay. You know, you and I thought maybe Isaiah on Steph might be a recipe for disaster. I thought Isaiah did a pretty good job, and then Bradley had so much value added on Clay that
Smart
clearly was the right move.
Smart also had some great moments on Clay off the ball.
Yeah.
And Clay is really more susceptible to defense, and his performances, I think, vary more. I haven't done any sort of study on this, but to me, they vary more based on the level of defense played, where Steph can have nights of being impervious to to defense. I think maybe the game in Utah is an example where he literally didn't have a clean look the whole game and still had 31 points on 23 shots. With Clay, he's somebody who I think of more as he's going to kill lazy defenses, and if he's facing great perimeter defenders, he's going to look very human like he did tonight.
Yeah, that may be so, but on the other hand, and this happened in the finals too, right? They just stuck him on Shumpert on him, but the fact that you just can never leave him, yeah, you might stop him, but now you're playing 4-on-4, I think is, even when he's not scoring, he's still having a great effect. Let's talk a little bit about the end of the game. The Warriors were down 7 with 2 minutes left. They roared back. Clay hit a 3 to cut it to 4. Then there was that sequence where Sullinger missed the post-up. Steph had an unbelievable defensive rebound, pushed it, got a layup there within 2. And then Draymond Green got that steal from Amir Johnson with about 30 seconds left. Did you think that was a foul?
Probably, but it was just a situation where... It's a situation, a swallow their whistle situation, I suppose, in crunch time. I mean, I haven't rewatched that particular play, so in real time, it looked like there was a lot of contact, but I couldn't clearly tell you what even the hell happened. It just seemed like a very Draymond Green play, where he used the jaws of life to just wrench the ball away, and just through force of will... create something, but probably technically a foul if I had to guess.
Yeah, and actually, I don't know that it actually was looking at it in super slow motion. But although Johnson probably should have been awarded the timeout that Green eventually was awarded after he took the ball away from Johnson on the ground, but then Draymond, after Kerr set up a beautiful play.
Oh, that play was so sick. Yeah. Oh, man.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. The play is great because it anticipates what Boston is going to do. And in this instance, they knew that you're just going to try to get the ball out of Steph's hands. And so pick and roll, Draymond with Steph. The Celtics trap it, and what the Warriors did was that they had Barnes come over anticipating the trap to then set a screen on Steph's man as the Celtics are scrambling to deal with the Draymond Green 4-on-3. And it seemed from what Draymond said after the game that it was kind of like your eyes getting too big for your stomach that he...
Yeah, we have that audio, actually. Let's,
oh, yeah, okay,
let's
okay.
Play that.
Draymond, you got that steal, and then on the other, after the timeout, lost the ball. What happened in that sequence?
Kind of started observing the floor before I really grabbed the ball and kind of saw the exact situation that we wanted and left the ball behind.
Yeah, so he said they had exactly what they're looking for, and if you go back and watch the replay, they had Steph wide open for a 3, and Clay was also in the corner, so he could have thrown it to either of those guys, and he just completely flubbed the catch right into Amir Johnson's hands, like never even got possession of it.
Yeah, and that kind of thing can happen on occasion, and I thought it was a very well-designed play and a very interesting way to deal with that trapping issue and to get it back to Curry. Just creative. So in a process over results kind of way, my main takeaway was that was a sick play and, it just didn't work out.
Yeah, Curry's ATOs lately have been fantastic in dealing with the precise strategy of the other team. When he knows they're switching, they can get some hard cuts right off the moment of the switch. They've done really well on that. This one, when they knew that they're sticking really close to Steph, getting like that back screen for him to the wing was really good. But I really think that the game was lost with some of the mental errors and just that incredible Boston shot making. And I mean, but from the errors standpoint, I mean, there was Isaiah Thomas coming down in transition and Steph and Barbosa not knowing who they had. There was Steph getting a backcourt violation at the end of the first half and then blowing a switch and Avery Bradley getting a 3 to put the Celtics up 2 going into halftime. They gave up a dunk to Jonas Jerebko on a baseline out of bounds after Barnes and Barbosa failed to communicate. There was probably for the end of the third quarter and the beginning of the fourth, they didn't get matched up in transition, and seemingly every time, they're in some sort of a miserable mismatch where someone could get a post up or Spates was going to get stuck defending one-on-one against guys like Smart. It really just the discipline was not there defensively, and for all the talk of the turnovers, that to me is what ultimately killed them.
Yeah, and it's obviously a combination. And even if defensively they screwed up and they were bereft, I still think that offensively, it's funny though. It's funny where I think we talked about this in the pre-show. It seemed like Kerr and Curry did not share our thinking on how the issue was not enough pick and roll. They didn't.
Yeah. In fairness to them, though, you have been asking them that question basically since the middle of last year, so they're probably ready for an answer to be on the same page and not look like Steph not looking like, hey, I'm not getting what I want here. Mm-hmm. You know, he's way too political to ever give that answer of like, hey, I wish we were doing X more strategically. I don't think I've ever heard him say anything about like, hey, I wish we were doing something different strategically in his whole career.
And I think this was actually more of an issue earlier last season where Steph, like any star or any superstar, wants the ball high pick and roll. That's what these guys like. That is the comfort zone that gives you an amount of control. You see what LeBron James likes, and pretty much anybody of those talents wants to do that. Kerr really had to sell him on this more egalitarian, as you've put it, way of doing things. And I think ultimately that's been for the best. It's just frustrating in certain situations where Rockhead, Oklahoma City, high pick and roll again and again, actually, that's just the best way.
against certain teams. I mean, when they have really slow bigs, I think that is probably the case, especially when neither of the bigs is really a guy that you want to have switching. Like when teams have been putting, you know, their three-man on Draymond Green so often now and taking that away, that Steph Draymond pick and roll away by switching it, that they should almost be ecstatic when the other team isn't able to do that and run that play more often, especially when the strength of the other team is having guys who are just going to get through screens and stick to Steph and Clay. And it's almost even kind of less work for Steph as well to just get the ball and run a high pick and roll than have to sprint off a screen all the time. So, you know, I think generally that moving the ball stuff is good, but especially when they just weren't scoring at all against this particular team, I think, you know, sort of going to the break glass in case of emergency, Steph high pick and roll is more the way to go.
Maybe it's just an aesthetic thing with me. There's just nothing I hate more than watching a blown up floppy set or just watching guys not be able to get open off the ball. There's just something frustrating about it where when the defender's sticking with them and zigging and just kind of going with the zigzags of it, just it's so I don't know. It feels more frustrating to me than something going wrong on the ball. I can't even tell you why. It's just aesthetic. But, you know, it's interesting when you mention the mental miscues in this game because people were remarking in the shoot-around, that it was just a really kind of jocular mood. People were loose and they were having fun. I even asked about it. I was just like, why is everybody so happy today? Usually this late in the season, you show up to a shoot around or a practice, and it's not like that necessarily. And the explanation I got is they know they have the record. They know they have 73 wins. That win in Utah effectively sealed it. So I do wonder if that contributed to what we saw later and ultimately the loss.
Well, especially with Jay Crowder being out too. You know, that I'm sure that was I gave them absolutely no chance, the Celtics, without Crowder. That obviously was incorrect. Crowder played last night and then experienced a little bit of swelling in his ankle. He says he plans to play on Sunday, but did not play in this game. And especially with the Warriors going small, you would think that Crowder would have been essential. But as it turned out, I mean, the Celtics bigs just kicked the crap out of the Warriors bigs. And that the fact that they sort of encouraged the Warriors to stay big, although, you know, again, without Iguodala, it's harder to go small, ended up being a big factor in the game. I asked Jared Sullinger about his performance and what the fact that he was hitting all those jumpers did.
You had the jumper working tonight. Did you notice more space out there for guys to drive in that third quarter once you knocked a couple down?
Oh, most definitely. I also noticed that they switched a little bit, which allowed me to duck in the smaller guy and let our guards get to the paint. I thought our guards did a great job of utilizing that matchup.
Yeah, so as he noted, guys are able to drive right down the lane because of what he was doing. They have a lot of confidence in the ability of their guys to finish, especially Thomas. And he also noted that he was able to get some duck-ins, and which he didn't say, but was also important, was he was able to get on the offensive glass on some of those switches as well for to the tune of 4 offensive rebounds.
How many players are like Jared Sullinger in the league? Just somebody who can be a wide body post up battering ram and who also shoots threes.
It's weird. Like fat guys are actually like seem to usually be pretty skilled.
Yeah, Boris Diaw is another guy we would put in there in that category.
Yeah, I mean, but like, you know, if you can't be in the league if you're a fat guy unless you have skills, right? I guess there's some selection bias there. But even like, you know, if you play pickup, usually like there'll be like a random fat guy who actually has like a ton of skills. It's kind of funny.
How skilled was the fat guy in Teen Wolf? I'm trying to remember. I'm just now.
Yeah, I've never seen that movie.
Really? Okay. Wow. I mean, it's not a good
movie. Yeah, I mean, it's, Michael J. Fox playing basketball just somehow like never appealed to me.
Well, I'd like your thoughts. Someday we need to actually watch this movie, and I want your thoughts about the various basketball scenes and Michael J. Fox's abilities.
That'll go right to the top of the priority list.
I mean, I know one popular NBA aficionado / columnist / impresario who's really worked Teen Wolf into his whole oeuvre. So I mean, it's possible. It can be done. But as you were saying, yes, fat guys, quite skilled. Sullinger had an awesome game. Evan Turner, as you've mentioned. I feel like I feel like when you say shot making, there's just like a hint of judgment there. When you say shot making, there is a hint of that was lucky. That was a little bit lucky.
No, I mean, they hit some crazy shots. I mean, there was a Linux threw in this hook that rimmed in that Turner shot on the baseline. Sullinger careened down the lane, threw it wildly off the backboard, and then got up for an offensive rebound and tip-in that Draymond was quite upset by because he had stopped him and nobody got the rebound late.
And at the same time, when you hit 23 pointers as the Warriors did and you lose, you probably deserved a lot.
The Celtics missed 11 of their 30 free throws too. I mean, that's the other thing. Like, I mean, they got outplayed in Utah and only won because of the free throw situation and Favors' injury. And the same thing happened here. And you know, this team is starting to wear down. They, I think, were kind of lucky to do as well as they have with Andre out, with Azeli out, even you know when Barnes was out earlier in the year as well. So you know, I think that this was kind of. This was supposed to be happening, and the fact that they had this early success made us kind of forget that, hey, you know, Andre Iguodala is pretty good. He's their fourth best player.
I've been waiting for this for a while. I've been expecting this for a while. It just doesn't make sense for them to be as good without someone who's really good. And then I think Festus Ezeli is also a good player, and Andre is somebody who probably trends more to towards excellent, or at least excellent in his particular role. So, yeah, not to make an injury excuse for this team, but it just made sense that some game like this would happen, that they would finally lose a game that they were trying to win. That's what happened tonight that rarely happens. They were trying to win and they lost.
Yeah, I agree. For the Celtics, now they are got a win that certainly the projection systems wouldn't have expected. They are now, the Hornets, Hawks, and Heat are all projected to finish with 48 and 34 records by your colleagues at 538. So a huge win for the Celtics. They seem to have weathered the storm without Jay Crowder. And, you know, now they have as good a chance of anybody really as getting that 3 seed in the East, which I think is going to be really important for them, you know, to avoid Cleveland and also have home court advantage in the first round.
I mean, I don't know what to tell you. I know that you want to vary it up. You don't want the podcast to be too Warriors-centric, and it was a fantastic win by the Celtics, who seem to be of a smart organization, and they play hard every night, and they've got an excellent coach. But I'm not sure what to add on top of that.
This is that no one gives a crap about Clyde Drexler.
No. It's just I have nothing to offer and nothing to add about the Eastern Conference playoff race. I all I can say is that I enjoy watching the Celtics, and I wish them the best of luck.
Yeah, all right. Well, so let me ask you this then. Of the Hornets, Celtics, Hawks, and Heat, which team do you find the most interesting of those four teams?
It's got to be the Heat. I mean, the Heat, I don't actually like watching them play. I don't enjoy their playing style, but they're just such an odd mix of things. And just how, what do they do with the Dwayne Wade situation? What do they do with the Hassan Whiteside situation? And Justice Winslow, you know, how is he progressing? There's something that's interesting about them in a narrative way that doesn't necessarily translate to their playing style, which I wouldn't classify as interesting, but I think I would choose them among those teams.
Yeah, I think so. There are a lot of interesting storylines with them. So the Warriors, 68-8 now. They are still projected to get the record by your colleagues at 538. Let's just go through the schedule, talk about a little bit of these games before I let you go. They play at home Sunday against Portland. There's some talk that Azili might come back for that game. How did they destroyed Portland last time, although Andre Iguodala, that's when he got injured by Lillard. He said that he held no ill will towards Lillard for that play, which I thought was a little bit reckless. But
I agree, you know, saying ill will towards Lillard is a reckless thing to do. It's very hard to pronounce. It just seems very difficult. I'm sorry. Continue.
What do you think of that game? You think, like, after coming off this win or after coming off this loss at home for the first time, that they're going to take care of business on Sunday?
I think so. I think Curry placed a priority on it. A little interesting subplot there. Well, actually, okay. Two things. I don't know if you've discussed this on the show, but you mentioned that play by Lillard that injured Iguodala. How did you feel about how Bogut talked about that particular play and how it was seen versus how it's seen when someone like Dellavedova does it?
I guess Bogut was sticking up for his Australian countrymen, but the fact is that's the first time Lillard has had a play like that, and Delly's had like six of them in the playoffs alone last year.
So you don't think it's just confirmation bias? You don't think there's anything to the idea that we judge a foreigner more for that sort of reckless play that might injure somebody than somebody else?
I think also the fact that it's not even necessarily that he's a foreigner so much as that he's like scrappy and playing hard as the, or, you know, playing right close to the line is the characteristic that we probably most associate with his game. But to me, it's just the multiple incidents ultimately that brought that up. But I mean, and I definitely thought of that, of those sorts of plays when Lillard did. I thought it was a very similar play, but he's had one of those instances, not a ton.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's something to that. I also find it interesting that it seems like Dellavedova gets more judgment for a reckless play than J.R. Smith, who I would say has far more dangerous reckless plays on his resume. And I do think that's a bit odd, even if you could.
Yeah, you know, that's true. I mean, and obviously Dellavedova is different than a lot of players in the league. And so, yeah, he might get a little bit more of that. I think that Delly's reputation is totally deserved, and that maybe, you know, other players should have more of a reputation than they do, Smith being foremost among them. I mean, he clocked Jay Crowder, in the face and almost tore his ACL last year.
I mean,
that's a pretty darn dangerous play.
It's kind of amazing to me, and I think the league should probably do more about the J.R. Smith situation, because he clearly just tries to injure people and punch people when he's angry and do it under the guise of the game flow. And he's done it often enough that it's not by accident. This is what he's doing. And eventually it's going to create maybe even a worse situation where somebody does tear an ACL. But shifting it back to Portland, how they're doing the Portland game and all everything about them and their the Warriors and their chase for 73 wins, it was interesting. Draymond was asked about whether he would communicate to Kerr if he was having any sorts of
Oh, yeah, yeah, we've got that audio.
Okay, yeah, this is good. This is good audio. This is good audio, people.
Kerr says he's got a pack with you guys, and you guys are having bumps or need rest. You tell him. You tell him if you got bumps? Will you tell him if he needs some rest, or you just want to play it out?
I'm playing.
Yeah, and that was actually, Draymond was a little short. I also asked him about why they're having trouble stopping the Celtics in the third quarter, and, you know, he didn't really have much of an answer there either.
What happened in the second half defensively, especially in the third quarter, they're able to get to the rim?
I think we really let Isaiah Thomas get going. You know, I think he had 0 points for quite a while, and you know, once you let him get going, it's tough. Stop. Not sure what happened, but it's tough.
kind of trying to laugh it off, but you could tell that he was not in a good mood about having lost this game, especially because
it's so ridiculous too how he'll say that other people thought about the home win streak more than we did, and it's just clearly the case that Draymond cares about all of these things and all of the records. And
oh yeah, I would care about it too. I mean, I was like, when I played Tecmo Bowl, the original Tecmo Bowl, not Super Tecmo Bowl, like I would write down every yardage that Bo Jackson got with rushing play number one and average it out and see whether I set the NFL record for, you know, highest average yards per carry. Like I would be doing the same thing as him. I would care about this stuff immensely.
Yeah, I'm just calling BS on it. I think it's good that he cares as much as he does, but I call BS on him acting as though he does not after the loss.
So Minnesota on Tuesday. That's a win. I mean, you're feeling likely though that they're going to take care of business against Portland.
I think so. I think they'll take care of business at home against Portland. I think so. Yeah, they'll respond.
And then so then it's San Antonio at home on Thursday, and then Memphis on Saturday, back to back with San Antonio on Sunday, and then Memphis at home the following Wednesday to finish things up. So they are going to have to beat the Spurs at least once to get the record.
That is an interesting setup, and that was just my personal travel in the back to back. Like that's what my life is like. It was funny. I was thinking after this particular loss, somebody was tweeting at me that they were putting the Jordan cry face on me because the Warriors lost, and I was thinking the proper thing to do would be to put the Jordan cry face on me at the moment it was announced tonight that the Warriors would have practice tomorrow on Saturday, and I would have to go to that.
Thank you for agreeing to come on this podcast and sticking to it beforehand.
That they'll have to beat the Spurs once is an interesting setup. I'd assume that's going to come at home. And a lot of it, I mean, there are a lot of unknowns here, right? We don't know how hurt Bogut might be. We don't know when Iguodala is coming back.
X-rays were negative on his ribs, supposedly. But yeah, I mean, they do need him because he's not Spates or Varejao right now.
Yeah, that's an important distinction, not being Spates or Varejao. Although Spates has been good, man. Spates has been good. He's just
the last two games he has not been, but before that he sure has been. I mean, he should be playing over.
I'm saying Kerr era Spates. Since Kerr came back, Spates has been good. Obviously, his defensive deficiencies, and it seems like they really want to keep him with Livingston, and they want them to do that side pick and roll. But they are thin up front right now, to say the least. And we don't know exactly when Festus is coming back, what Festus will look like, and we don't know when Andre Iguodala is coming back. Because, I like them to beat the Spurs at home, but I kind of want to know if Iguodala is playing that day.
Well, and Greg Popovich did say he thought that going 41-0 at home was worth, quote, a cup of coffee. Maybe that, so something along those lines. But now that the Warriors aren't going to get that record, maybe there's a little more motivation for them to go for it. Maybe they just don't think that way at all. But
you know what's funny? It seems like players care more about this stuff maybe than coaches do. I feel like with the Warriors, at least, I don't think Kerr cares about this stuff, and he wants them to take the long view like Popovich does. But when you play that Draymond Green sound, like, how much control do you really have? How much control does Kerr really have to tell these guys you have to sit? It seems like Popovich actually can execute that vision, and Popovich legitimately doesn't seem to care about that kind of thing. And he doesn't have the same issue of having to manage younger, bigger egos that Kerr might have.
Yeah, you know, Tim Duncan and Tony Parker and Manu Ginobili have all accomplished so much in their careers now. And, you know, this Warriors team believes that they are the best team of all time, and they want everybody to know that, especially when you consider that they were getting a bunch of crap for having, like, not done it, you know, not beating the right teams, and that they were, like, you know, 9-2 or something to win the NBA title at the start of the year, which was ridiculously low.
So the question is that ultimately going to be their downfall? Is this going to be their tragic flaw that in trying to prove they're the greatest team of all time, they're going to burn themselves out and not rest when they should, and that's what's going to do it? I mean,
Nah, I don't think so. They'll be fine.
You think they'll be fine?
I mean, Kerr has been adamantly been saying Steph, Clay, Draymond are all guys who are in their prime. We don't think that they need rest. Now, you know, Draymond said he wasn't really interested in resting in that audio that we just played.
Even if something's wrong with him, it would seem to be the insinuation.
Yeah, but I don't know. I think it's worth it. To me, it's worth it because, like, this is the 73. They already won a championship. If they hadn't won the championship last year, then I think that it would make a little more sense to me to be like, all right, you know, calm down. Let's make sure we at least win one. But, you know, these guys are competitive. As long as those guys stay healthy, and maybe you can say they're more likely to injure themselves without the rest, but, you know, I don't think anyone truly knows that. You know, I think they'll be fine. And especially if they get to play Memphis in the first round, then they'll get plenty of rest.
I've heard on good authority that they are light years ahead of the league, so I think they should be able to they should be able to afford burning a few more calories here at the end.
Oh yeah, yeah. Can we get like you know, 90 seconds on Lacob's comments? I read that quote on yesterday's show with Danny, but I neglected to include the part of Lacob saying that they're light years ahead of everyone else in how they're doing things. What did you think of that whole spiel?
I probably have more than 90 seconds on it. I was talking to some people, some Warriors officials at Shootaround about it and how and the big response to it and how they thought it was a really good profile because everybody is divided into two camps where they really enjoy it and liked the candor from Lacob or they regard him as an arrogant jerk. Probably more of the latter, I think. More of the latter people view him that way. But we do have this funny paradox where we want people to be honest, and then when they're honest, we yell at them and we act as PR consultants and say they shouldn't have said that. And so, hey, you know, what Lacob said was impolitic. I don't think it's the smartest thing to say if you're trying.
Well, it's also not true.
It's probably not true. I would say probably. Well, A, it's definitely not true because light years aren't even a measurement that you would apply to how your organization is doing versus another organization. So it's objectively not true in that case. And they're probably not completely ahead of organizations. This did make me curious, by the way, as to what they're exactly doing that other teams aren't. And that's something I'm asking about and trying to get actually nailed down. But this is the attitude. As much as we're judging it and saying that it's arrogance and it's hubris, it is the attitude that swiped the team from Larry Ellison, somebody who had a lot more money than Lacob and theoretically a lot more power. That sort of ambition to grab the team and to push it forward, I think, has informed the success to a great degree. So,
They've gambled repeatedly and they've won. You know, I mean, Lacob saying that he's like considers himself one of the world's foremost blackjack players. Mm-hmm. As well, and has won, you know, millions of dollars, you know, multiple times playing blackjack. I mean, this is an organization that has loved to gamble, and almost invariably that's paid off. The only time it really hasn't was when they amnestied Charlie Bell and tried to sign DeAndre Jordan in restricted free agency and used the amnesty at Bell instead of Beatrice,
which, by the way, they'll try to justify by saying, hey, DeAndre Jordan turned out to be really good, so at least we had that part of the equation correct. But that sort of attitude from Lacob, and if I'm totally honest, okay, here's how I feel about it. I think it was impolitic to say because they need to convince Steph Curry to come back and they shouldn't be sending out the message that, that he is just a piece of this whole thing. So that's the political aspect of it. But I am more inclined to think that there's something to what they're saying, that the management aspect of what the Warriors has done has not gotten enough credit.
I think it's gotten about the right amount of credit.
I don't think they
didn't create a player who is making shots that nobody else in NBA history has even thought about taking, much less making. Like, that is the number one aspect. They've done a great job, but I think you would have to say
I just
50% of what they've accomplished is not management's.
I happen to think from having been around the team when it was bad that a bad managerial structure and just general incompetence, it seeps into everything and it destroys and corrodes everything. And this idea that we have about players that they are a fixed value that will be the same value anywhere is just incorrect. And the question is, what is Steph Curry's career if Chris Cohan never sells the team? I think it might be kind of an ugly scenario. And that's odd to think about, was now we're talking about a player who's rising up the ranks of greatest season of all time, possibly, and surefire Hall of Famer. But I mean, I could easily see a scenario where Chris Cohan never sells the team and he's just got repeated injuries and he's swaddled in incompetence, and we don't even think of him that as a Hall of Famer, even an All-Star. So I do think that the managerial aspect of a basketball team is incredibly important, but it's also incredibly abstract. So how do we even really appreciate what's happening behind the scenes to inform the on-court product? I just happen to think that we overvalue what we see and undervalue what we don't.
Well, they've done about as good of a job as they possibly could have, with a couple of small exceptions. But the point to me is, even if you do absolutely as good a job as you possibly could have, the amount of luck required and the fact that Steph was already on the team when they purchased it, and I agree with you that they've provided him with the best possible ecosystem to succeed. Like, don't get me wrong there. But, I mean, the idea, if Steph had not been on the team to start, they're not at this point right now. There's just no way.
The thing I find interesting about Lacob is that he seems to see something in people he hires that he himself does not possess. When he talks, as you read in this article, he doesn't necessarily have, I don't want to say an emotional intelligence, because that sounds, I don't know, that sounds judgmental, but he will come off as arrogant. He will come off as a jerk in the way he communicates. And yet he has hired Bob Myers and Steve Kerr, who seem to have incredible emotional intelligence and to be more understanding of people. And that's just an interesting Lacobian trait to me, to not have something, but to be able to see it and to be able to value it.
Yeah, not really much to say on that. He's obviously done a great job of hiring. You know Joe better than I do. I've only had a couple of very short conversations with him. But, you know, I think ultimately there's just nothing good and could come of those comments, and something bad definitely could. So it was
But it's funny, but aren't you glad you have them? I mean, aren't you glad they exist?
We could find some other stuff to talk about. I mean, you know, like the Eastern Conference is fascinating. Like, you should try paying more attention.
I don't have the great teams of the West are light years ahead of the East. I don't have to think of these.
That is a way in which light years absolutely does accurately measure something. All right, that's good enough. So I'll let you go here. I know you got to get up for practice. Thanks so much for joining us. You can follow Ethan on Twitter at Sherwood Strauss. He usually writes a gamer that posts about midnight after every Warriors game, which are always excellent. He also wrote a fantastic article, which I'm sure everyone listening to this has already read, about how Nike lost Steph Curry and Under Armour got him. And you can follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. Give us a rating on iTunes, a review on iTunes, and also patronize our sponsor, Indochino Custom Menswear, with that cap space code. Talk to y'all next time.